it's time for Type 40 with a Doctor Who podcast on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we take an in-depth and closer look at this beloved television series, The Merchandise. Those spin-offs, remember them. Even the fandom itself, Doctor Who's this global phenomenon that's shaped the landscape of science fiction and fantasy for well over five decades. So step into our TARDIS and share our journey together here on Type 40. Ooh, welcome to Type 40, materialising again in your ears. Autumn 2019, it's wet and grey out there as I speak to you. And we're going all grey too. We're going analogue and black and white this time on the show with our very first review in some months, really, because we've got new Doctor Who to talk about. Well, I say new, it's new old Doctor Who, kind of, to talk about. What's he going on about? We'll explain in a moment. He's Dan Hadley. Rain or shine, I'm your regular Type 40 pilot, Birmingham's King of the Geeks and lifelong Doctor Who fan, as maybe you are, or maybe not. Whatever the subject and however deep the dive, this show's for everybody, just like Doctor Who at its best. Anytime there's any danger of me forgetting that, there's always somebody willing to sort of pull me back on track. And more often than not, well, it's this brave soul. By day, he's a TV industry professional and writer. But by night, he's space agent Simon Shoot-'em-up Horton. Welcome back, Simon. How are things in your quadrant?
I like that introduction. They're definitely... I don't know where to go with that. It's lovely to be back with you, Dan. It's actually, this is what you're saying. It's sort of cold and grey in October out there. This is my favourite time of the year. I love from sort of September through to Christmas. And part of that is undoubtedly to do with Doctor Who, simply because obviously historically September, October would have been the time that we were all settling down and watching the new season. And then of course, I'm so incredibly nostalgic about the Five Faces of Doctor Who season from 1981. Was it 81?
Oh yeah, it certainly made that autumn fly by, didn't it?
Certainly did. And then of course you've got the anniversary in November. So this is it's always a special time for Doctor Who fans. And so it just happens to be wonderfully ironic and coincidental that the stuff we're going to talk about today was first broadcast at this time of year.
Well, yeah, now you come to mention it. And that's no coincidence. That was all part of the plan as well. But I know exactly what you mean. This time of year, autumn without Doctor Who never really seemed quite right. And when they moved it, of course, in the new series, they moved it to the autumn, whenever it was, like 2011, I think it was, and they started breaking and shuffling them around. And I was over the moon at first, and then, they started splitting things up, and it all went rather pear-shaped, didn't it? It didn't really work out the way I think any of us wanted.
I think that's a fair point.
Darkening nights and glimmering pictures of our youth, In the days before plasma and before LCD, when everything was CRTs and tracking and things like that. Oh, we're on the nostalgia bus already. We're going back even further. But it's two-pronged today, back to 1965. Oh dear. But before we get cleared for liftoff, there's a couple of fixed points to cover, as always, as part of the Fandom Podcast Network, because you can find each and every edition of our show, past, present and future, on the FPNet master feed at fpnet.podbean.com and FPNet on the Podbean app. The Fandom Podcast Network's also on Spotify, Stitcher and Google Play, as well as the Apple Podcasts app, formerly known as iTunes, of course, as you may have noticed. That's disappeared. In its place, Apple Podcasts. Search for us there, add us and share us if you're feeling particularly brave. There's our social media presence, of course, Instagram and Twitter. We're Type 40 Doctor Who. There's the Type 40 Facebook page and matching Facebook group. That's the very heart of our TARDIS, the lively, inclusive Facebook group that's growing every week. And we sincerely appreciate all of our members there. You'd like them too. Some of them, maybe. Oh, dear. Yeah, there's links in the show notes, as always, for all of that. Simon, remind everybody what it is you do and where you do it.
You can come and find me on Facebook under The Hoonatics. If you just look up The Hoonatics, WHONATICS, you will find me there as the admin.
There you go, The Hoonatics on Facebook. Oh. There's a whole several worlds of Doctor Who to discover and rediscover. And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter as The Spacebook, talking and sharing about, well, not just Doctor Who, everything outside of the TARDIS in movies, TV, comics, books, and gaming for the gamers listening. Oh, there's plenty of gamers out there. I don't game myself. Daily, it's all going on in the Spacebook Facebook group. Come and find us. Come and have a chat. Somebody will chat. Even if I'm not around, somebody will have a chat. Yes. Space, the final frontier, Simon. That's where we're going this time.
Yeah, apparently so.
Space in 1965. Was a starting point.
I was minus three then. I don't know about you. I was minus 3 years old at that point.
I was barely even thought of. Before we go onto the hostile landscape of the planet Kemble. There we go. It's a bit like the British winter down there, come to think of it. And, if you need an extra layer, if you want to start layering up, you need to go to our Tee Public store. It's really easy to go browsing there. You can search for the Fandom Podcast Network, find our storefront, and you can choose from this wide variety of original designs on mugs, T-shirts, hats, tapestries, of not just the Type 40 logo, the beautiful Type 40 logo, but all the logos of all the other shows too. And yeah, you can click on that, add to cart, treat yourself or a loved one, and it all helps to support the Fandom Podcast Network into the bargain. Whether they're a geek or not, they don't need to know what they're wearing. Get it anyway. Get it all in. And yeah, why not? Get everybody wearing the colours. Now I think we get straight into it and talk about Doctor Who. Simon and I don't know about you, Simon, I'm very excited about all this. I think this is the most exciting thing to happen in Doctor Who fandom all year, and it's a gap year, obviously, so it's not that hard, but there's a certain irony in that, because although the BBC, they're not behind it, but they've got behind it in a sense, seemingly late in the day, but there are people out there might be asking exactly what is Mission to the Unknown. It's quite a unique Doctor Who story, wouldn't you say, Simon? 40 years before one-part stories became the norm.
Yeah,
Russell T. Davis launched the show. We had this oddity, Mission to the Unknown.
Absolutely, the truth of it is, it's 100% totally unique. There is no other episode like Mission to the Unknown, even when you take the current series into account, because it's the only single 25-minute story that happens in isolation in its entirety in those 25 minutes. And it's also the only episode ever in the entire run of the series that doesn't feature any of the regular cast at all. Because although you've had in the modern series, you've had things like Love and Monsters, Blink, etc., that have had a minimal input from the Doctor or from a companion, they've still appeared in them. Whereas Mission to the Unknown is literally a unique, standalone 25-minute story that you can literally pick out and watch on its own, and it begins and it ends, and that's the end of it. It's an oddity, to say the very least. Certainly in the Billy Hartnell days, it was very normal for either the Doctor or one of the companions not to appear in an episode, simply because they were making it for the vast majority of the year. And so literally the stars had to have holidays, and so they would deliberately write an episode that didn't feature one of the regular cast, so one of them could take
only ever one at a time.
That's right. And so this is the only episode where none of them appear, and they're not even mentioned. You know, the Doctor and companions, the TARDIS, never gets a mention. It's literally like, for reasons that will probably become obvious during the discussion, it's very much like a short story from one of the Dalek 1960s annuals. You could literally, they could have just televised one of those stories. They could have dramatised one of the stories from one of the annuals, because that's how it plays.
Or even an anthology show from the mid to late 50s. They're popular both in America and in the UK. We both had different anthology series that run sometimes for years and years and years. Obviously, most famously, The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, things like that. And it stands, I suppose, as sort of one of those. But it was broadcast originally on the 9th of October 1965, the original version, written by Terry Nation, the Dalek Master Termination, and filmed alongside the season three, the actual opening story, Galaxy Force. So whilst this was sort of going on and in production as part of the same block, the cast were working. They were working on that four part story, which for the most part also doesn't really exist. But the other curious thing about Mission to the Unknown is that it acts as, it's standalone, but it isn't, because it acts as this sort of prologue for this much longer story to come later on. But I've got a quick synopsis of the story here. It takes place on the planet Kemble, where Space Security Service Agent Mark Corey is investigating a recent sighting of a Dalek spaceship. His suspicion that the creatures may have established a base there proves well-founded. He learns of their plot to invade and destroy our solar system. Nearby, the Daleks themselves are waiting with their allies with a plan to conquer the universe, beginning with the planet Earth. So, yeah, this isn't strictly speaking what we're reviewing today, though, is it, Simon? Because, you know, as you may or may not be aware, that original episode has long since been missing from the archives. We're here to talk predominantly about something called Mission to the Unknown 2019, this extraordinary fresh project mounted earlier on in the year by a whole new generation of cast and crew, and miles away from Ealing or Television Centre or anywhere else. But why can't we watch the original Mission to the Unknown, Simon? What happened?
Oh, because the BBC, God bless them in their wisdom, got rid of it, as they did with so many. Is it 99 episodes that are now missing? I think it's just dipped below the 100 mark, hasn't it?
Around that, yeah.
Which is just still a terrible loss. And chances are Mission to the Unknown is one of those that probably will never reappear, simply because, again, because of its unique nature as a standalone episode. I think a lot of foreign sales didn't happen for Mission to the Unknown, simply because almost the broadcasters didn't really know what to do with it, because it was just this one single episode that didn't fit desperately well. And so I think a lot of the international broadcasters just let it drift and didn't worry about buying it. And so as a result, it's probably, unfortunately, one of those episodes we'll probably never ever get to see. It's long since gone, and only at the moment in its original form exists in a series of telly snaps taken from the screen at the time and an audio recording, and that's all we've got of that original broadcast, and probably that will remain forevermore.
So it was what you could term a hard sell.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's interesting. The whole premise of the episode in itself was very much seen by Terry Nation as a precursor to possibly an American Dalek series, completely away from Doctor Who. He was trying at the time to sell a Dalek series featuring the Special Space Security Corps to America. And so for him, this was an ideal opportunity to actually show the kind of thing that the series would have been had the Americans bought it, which ultimately, of course, it fell apart and it never worked. So not only is it a precursor to the Dalek Master Plan, the 12-part epic, but it's also was intended to be a kind of a sales pitch, almost a showreel for what a Doctor-less Dalek series could be on television.
He had his eyes on that prize for a very long time, didn't he? And this is kind of what they call now in TV terms a backdoor pilot.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to know, I don't know the answer to this one. I don't know whether anybody does or whether it's just lost to the mists of time. Which came first? Mission to the Unknown as a standalone episode that then inspired Terry Nation to think, oh, hold on, I could use this. Or whether the Dalek series was already in discussion prior to that. And so Mission to the Unknown acted as something of a godsend to Terry Nation at that point. I think they pretty much happened simultaneously, so I'm not quite certain which came first, the chicken or the egg. Don't quite know. But whatever, it's a unique episode, and I can remember reading about it years and years ago when I was a very early young fan, and reading in the programme guide about this what is occasionally called Dalek cutaway episode, and it just sounded so intriguing, this single episode that the Doctor and his companions never appear in. And then, of course, after the Mission to the Unknown episode, they go away and they do 4 weeks in Galaxy 4, sorry, in the Mythmakers, and then they come back 4 weeks later to the actual Daleks' master plan that they kind of left 5 weeks previously at the end of Mission to the Unknown. It's really way ahead of its time, this episode, and you forget
that. As you say, as you say, for a long time as well, it had that, it was going under that name of Dalek Cutaway, so it didn't even, it was that mysterious, it didn't even have its own name.
It's
But Mission to the Unknown has always been its on-screen title, though, hasn't it?
Absolutely, but for some reason it just got classed as Dalek Cutaway, because that's exactly what it is. It is a Dalek Cutaway from the Daleks' master plan. But it was really brave. I still don't quite understand the logic of them at the time of breaking then the Daleks master plan and Mission to the Unknown with the Mythmakers in the middle. It's still logically, you would have just in effect made a 13-part series of Daleks master plan. But I love the fact that the Mythmakers comes in the middle of it, because it somehow gives such legitimacy to, and it's such a modern idea. It's such a 21st century idea to do this standalone episode that does nothing for 4 weeks and then comes back. It's a story arc, as they would say in modern parlance. Yes. And that's
I have heard talk about this whole thing, that it was still a knock-on effect from actors being contracted for a certain amount of episodes per year, whereby they had to be credited for what they would get from the actors' union. You know, because Bill Hartnell does get a credit on this episode, on the original episode, even though he's technically not in it, he's able to get a credit on that because of that allocation per year, where of course the other cast members don't. And I think it's sort of carried over and carried over right from as far back as Planet of Giants, that it had this sort of knock-on effect. And this was the last episode produced by the late great Verita Lambert as well, so maybe it was a certain amount of cleaning house was going on before she handed over to whoever was next. Who was the next producer? I can never remember. John Wiles.
John Wiles. Yeah, it was John Wiles.
So there could be something in that. But when I look at this on paper, and I mean, you think to yourself, if I was a child watching this at the time, Doctor Who's say audience of say 6 or 7 year olds, and we're talking about it being a hard sell in any sense of the word, if the Doctor and his companions aren't in it, who is in it, Simon? Who starred in this originally?
Well, of course, originally you'd got Edward D'Souza as Mark Corey, who wonderfully is in footage of coming back to the set of the new recreation. And Jeremy Young, who plays Gordon Lowry. And of course, Jeremy Young had been in the very, very first story. He was in An Unearthly Child, playing Cal. So he was coming back to the fold. And then you've got various people. You'd obviously got the usual suspects of John Scott Martin, Gerald Taylor, Kevin Mansour, all playing Daleks. You've got Peter Hawkins and David Graham back as Dalek voices. So this was very much business as usual, in that this was absolutely... The repertory company of Doctor Who was in this episode, so it's very, very legitimate episode.
I recognise Jeremy Young's name, and I suppose, this was Verity's last episode, and there are some fantastic pictures, aren't there, that exist from the filming of this episode with Verita Lambert on set with some of the various actors and creatures and things. That can't have been a coincidence that all those people were brought back.
Absolutely. And of course, the other thing that's so memorable about this particular episode is all those delegates that they have around the conference table. And again, it's easy to forget how significant that was. In many ways, that was the first serious number of weird looking aliens that you had in an episode. I guess the web planet is the closest that would come to that. But this weird collection of Star Trek like aliens that were quite, I mean, they were very, very imaginative. Those delegates that appear, the names and the visual representations of these characters was really quite groundbreaking for Doctor Who back in the day. It's easy to forget. This was 1965. You know, people were used to watching Dixon and Doc Green and the like, and Coronation Street. And so to sort of see these really weird collection of people masquerading across the set, it was quite groundbreaking, even by Doctor Who standards. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all straight-faced and grotesque. The thing I suppose you could say it's similar to, and I like to get these things in whenever I can, 10 or 12 years before Star Wars, you could say this was the first cantina sequence, couldn't you?
Absolutely. In many ways, it is the cantina sequence done on a budget, on a BBC budget. And this, again, to me, just shows the sort of imagination and the enthusiasm of the production team back in those days, that they weren't afraid to try and, let's make half a dozen weird-looking delegates up. And they do it. And actually, I have to be honest, I still think they stand the test of time. Okay, they are a little bit cardboard and a little sticky back plastic, but the designs themselves, they really went for it. And they stand up for me. They look pretty good. They're as good. When you look, to use your comparison of the cantina sequence in Star Wars, you look at some of those creatures in the cantina, and let's be brutally honest, a lot of them aren't that much better. They're just on a bigger budget.
Yes, and if you'd like to get in touch and respond to that, that's Simon Horton who's just said that. No, I do. I think with the best one in the world, it's absolutely right. And I found out earlier on today while I was looking up this story that there was one of the working titles, one of the other titles considered for the story, was the Beasts of UGH. UGH standing for Universal Galactic Headquarters. That was nearly the title of this episode.
Whoa, I'm just not sure that would have worked as well as Mission to the Unknown somehow.
No, but me neither.
Isn't it funny? Mission to the Unknown is just such a pulpy sci-fi title. It could be out of Amazing Stories magazine or Action Comic, Eel Comic. You know, it's just such a pulpy title for actually what is a very, very pulpy 1950s SF tale, but it's great fun. It's a fun little 25-minute romp.
It does make you wonder. I mean, maybe if Doctor Who would have continued along these tracks and along these lines before it became like a very sort of monster orientated show, maybe that there would have been other cutaways, other little experiments like this. I mean, because the main reason I believe that this was put into play was because of that production schedule you talked about, and Verity Lambert simply wanted to give the cast a week off.
That's right.
Time to go on holiday.
That's right. She had absolutely no choice. She really needed to give them a week off because, as I say, we forget that they were in production for near enough the whole year, barring, as I say, a few weeks of holiday here and there. And the other thing, of course, that's got to be remembered is this was made in the days when they were literally flying by the seat of their pants with this production schedule. They didn't, unlike the modern show that these days is very much written, planned, scheduled very much in advance, very far in advance. They were making these episodes sometimes only about a month before transmission. And so they were still thinking, we've still got one episode, what are we going to do? And so that also is a bit of the history of Mission to the Unknown. It was a bit of we've got to give the cast a week off. We've got an episode free. What on earth can we do? And so that's when the idea came to them to do this cutaway to lead up to Mission to the Daleks' master plan. As far as I know, it was never a grand plan to say, let's do a pre-episode to preempt it. This really was making it up as they went along. And again, to me, it just shows the quality of the team that was working at that time, that they could do that. All credit to them. And ironically, I think, Terence Dix, bless him, we're going to keep on talking about Terence Dix. Terence Dix, one of the things that he most famously said was, look, we weren't worrying too much about stuff. We just needed to get the show on the screens, and it was a kick bollock scramble just to get that done. And I think, in a way, that's such a humbling attitude to take, because, of course, what they did was brilliant television. But for them, for the production teams in the 60s, 70s in particular, they were just trying to get a show on the screens to fill that slot. That's all they were trying to do, and we're still watching them 30, 40, 50, 60 years later.
So a real momentum to it. And I think that as Doctor Who fans, we do sort of mythologize this stuff a lot. and make out that it was all like quite profound and planned out and things like that. But then there's the other side to us that hears stories like that, and oh, they were just doing it because they needed a holiday, but needed a break. And the make, do and mend, and the necessity being the mother of invention, which I say quite a lot, I know, but it's true, and it adds to the charm of the show and something to be that little bit more proud of.
Yeah, it's very. I think you're absolutely right, Dan. It's very true, and I think in many ways this is why Doctor Who has actually stood the test of time in the way that other series haven't, from the similar time period. Simply because, whilst they were just trying to get a show on the screen, there was, for some reason, there was an awful lot of love poured into Doctor Who. It wasn't, although it was seen very much just get 25 minutes on the screen every week to fill that slot in, there was a lot of love and care and attention going into that. And of course that has then carried through right the way through into the modern series of the 21st century. The difference is they've got a lot more money and a lot more time to do it. So again,
and a lot more time to make up excuses for not doing it as well. But yeah, to talk about the passage of time, here we are now in the it was filmed in the summer of 2019, but now we're drifting into late 2019, and enter this thing called UCLAN, which is that stands for the University of Central Lancashire. It's not some sort of clandestine James Bondian organisation. But yeah, they step in, and you think, well, how on earth could this situation possibly have happened? Because what happened is that students, graduates and staff from this university have got together and remounted Mission to the Unknown. It was part of a whole thing that they'd got going on over the summer period, where they would restage a classic production. Apparently they've done it over and over again with all different manner of productions over the years as they train their students and graduates for basically training them for a world of work. It was done as part of a project called Sci-Fi in a Week, it says here, and they'd got 5 days, just 5 days, to rehearse and film the entire thing. And it was put together by their pro vice chancellor, and I'm thinking, what could be a serious lunatic, Dr. Andrew Ireland, who spearheaded the whole project. They sought and was granted permission to do so by both the BBC and the Terry Nation Estate, which is, as we know, is very historically tricky to do for any project. And they managed to even get the great Nicholas Briggs involved, the current voice of the Daleks, to play the voice of the Daleks in this. So yeah, they've mounted this production completely as fresh as new, ground up, and recorded it. I mean, I don't think it was ever meant for a mass audience, but of course here we are, just a few months later. Everybody in fandom came to find out about it. I'm sure that wasn't by accident, because they had like a Q&A session. Nick Briggs had talked about it, so we sort of came to find out that it was going on. Is it a point, Simon, that when something like this comes into fandom, into this arena, people start talking about it, there comes a point where the natural question to ask is, okay, you've told us about this, which is all well and good, and it's all very lovely, but why can't we see it, or when can we see it?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the whole story of this being recreated came out of the blue sometime in early summer, might even have been late spring. I just remember suddenly hearing about somebody's doing Mission to the Unknown, a university. Sorry, it just was one of those weird stories that came out of nowhere. And then the next thing you know, it's front page story on the magazine. And suddenly, okay, so this is quite serious. The magazine has dedicated the front page and a large part of its interior to this recreation that students are doing about Mission to the Unknown. It was just very, very left field. If you'd have asked me on January 1st, what is the most unlikely Doctor Who story that is going to happen this year, this probably would have been it. Some students recreating Mission to the Unknown. But it's interesting because you're right. Immediately, everybody's ears pricked up. It's interesting to know whether people's ears would have pricked up quite so much if they were going to remake, I don't know, the first episode of The Daleks or whatever it might have been, one that already exists in the archive. So it's difficult to know whether that would have generated the same interest. Well, the truth of it is it wouldn't. It's as simple as that. No. It wouldn't have generated the same interest. But immediately hearing this, everybody jumped on top of it. People were talking, and you're quite right, Dan. Everybody was saying, when can we see this? We must be able to see this. And I can't help thinking that if, as you point out, we understand that these guys went to the BBC and the Terry Nation estate first to actually ask permission to do it, I can't help thinking that the BBC and the Terry Nation estate would have said, okay, yeah, we grant permission, and depending on what it's like, we might consider releasing it. You can't release it yet. You absolutely don't get permission to release it. But once it's done, let us look at it. And we then decide whether you are able to release it. I think that must have been something that was known up front before they even produced the thing. I think the university themselves must have had an inkling that the BBC would consider releasing it if it was of a standard that they deemed good enough to do. And so all credit to them that that's happened.
Because it's only fair to point out as well, isn't it, that not a single penny of licensed fee payers' money went into making this. This would have been done via the average budget for the university, for the year, would you say?
Absolutely. Undoubtedly, unless the BBC gave them almost a grant to help them in producing it. But I think that's probably unlikely, given the fact that, as you say, the university has done this on a number of other occasions. Every year, by the sounds of it, they've made something. I'm guessing it was done entirely off their own backs and their own budget. And I have to be honest, I'm just so envious of them. You know, I did 3 years doing film directing as a degree, and we never got to do anything like remaking a Doctor Who episode. And I would have given my back teeth to remake a Doctor Who episode. So. All credit to them, that brilliant for the students to do this.
And I suppose, as well as flexing their muscles and skills that they've gained throughout the academic year or their two or three years potentially, it's opportunity for them to bring all those skills into play, and to align with generations past, with their ancestors, who the pioneers of the industry, and to go back to something as culturally significant of Doctor Who, where a part of its history has been lost, and to sort of stitch it back in a sense, because although, you know, needless to say, it could have been two or three stops down the line before anybody could have got to see this, the fact is it would have existed, and it from now on something would always have existed again on film. That stirs me. You can imagine how you would have responded when you were a student as well.
Absolutely. And what is also interesting with all of this is you talk about that these students were able to bring in the whole discipline of what they've learned. Well, what's interesting, I've always, as a film graduate, I've always very much supported the idea of students learning to make things in the old style, in inverted commas, prior to non-linear editing on Avid Suites, etc., prior to everybody making everything on a small digital camera on their smartphone. I've always very much been an advocate of, no, if you learn the hard way, as they were making it in the 60s, as opposed to the easier way now, where anything goes and it's much easier to do it. I think that's a very good discipline to have. And so what I think is so admirable about this Mission to the Unknown remake is the fact that they've gone back to basics. They've not done it totally true to how it would have been made in the 60s, simply because they had 5 days to film it, whereas back in the day, without me looking it up, I'm assuming they shot it all in one day in the studio. But the fact still remains, they have gone back to basics, and they've used that old school discipline of how to make a programme. And I think, if nothing else, that's brilliant for the students, and that's how they should be doing it.
Yeah, I believe they shot it over a 2-day period with a very clear sort of break, as they had to manage the studio space. Because although the sets weren't huge, there would have been a certain amount of management of the resources and of applying makeup.
This is the remake. The remake yeah. We're talking. Okay.
Yeah. So I believe so.
So they made it over 5 days, but they shot it over 2. Is that what?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. To rehearse and record to bring about something that is as close to the show as it would have been originally made and broadcast authentically.
Okay, that's interesting. If that's the case, that I didn't realise that. I thought they'd shot it over a longer period of time. If that's the case, then that is going to be fairly true to how that original 1965 episode was made, because generally they would have had 4 days rehearsal and 1 day filming for an episode on 1960s Doctor Who. So that's not a million miles from absolutely how it would have been shot at the time. And all credit to them that it looks as amazing as it does.
Well, evidently it's not just us that feel that way, because the recreation of Mission to the Unknown premiered on the Doctor Who YouTube channel October the 9th at 5:50 p.m. British Summer Time, which was the exact same time back in 1965 that original one had originally aired 54 years earlier. And so they gave it, over a period of about a week and a half, they gave it a real publicity push with trailers. There'd been a big announcement, a big countdown, but they were very, very proud of having this on YouTube. There are 1.3 million subscribers to the BBC's official YouTube channel. And obviously, you know, if you're a Doctor Who fan, odds are you are subscribed to that channel. You certainly know that it's there, and so this would have definitely have made your radar. But you know, we talk about the guy who's brought this into being. I've got a quick quote here from Dr. Andrew Ireland, and he does indeed say, "I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, and this episode in particular has always held an air of mystique for me because it experimented with the notion of the Daleks carrying their own storyline. We kept it as close to the original as we possibly could, so everything from the props and costumes to the acting style, pace and camera techniques are designed to be very 1960s. There was a Q&A session that breaking up the recording with the actor Edward D'Souza, as you mentioned, who originally played Mark Corey. And when asked about it himself, he said, "None of us thought that it would mean anything at all. It was just another episode of Doctor Who. It didn't really impinge on us at the time. And it wasn't much more than a week's work for me." So, you know, it's the typically sort of modest response we get from pretty much even regular cast members of Doctor Who, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because of course that kind of attitude is very different to the modern attitude where, you know, I've said before about how it can get somewhat tiresome with modern Doctor Who, where we're constantly told, "This is the best episode you've ever seen. This is brilliant. We're delighted to have this actor." And they're going on endlessly about how brilliant it all is. Back in the day, it's like I say, they just needed to get an episode on screen and they did it. And they were very humble about it and they weren't aware of the weight of legacy that was following them behind. And so again, this to me is why the classic series will always score over the modern series, simply because they were just doing a job where they didn't have the awareness that the current team, that the modern teams have had. And so there is a greater responsibility on modern teams to actually follow through. Back in the day, it really was just a week's work and they just got on and did it. And that much more pragmatic, down-to-earth approach just sits much better with me than rhetoric of being told that it's the best thing you're ever going to watch. and that's why the episodes just stand up so much better than modern episodes. Simple as that for me.
And they do stand up well. I mean, obviously it's a great shame that we can't watch the original. I would imagine that you have. I've seen the reconstruction from Loose Cannon, and I've seen Ian Levine's animated version as well over the years. So this is a story that I have been able to partake of before, but never really truly feel that I can say that I've seen. So now we've got the what's and the how's and the where's and the who's out of the way, I suppose the next question, the next topic, the most important of them all really, is all this aside, Simon, now that we've seen Mission to the Unknown 2019, what did you think of this?
I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I really, really enjoyed seeing it. I've seen a reconstruction somewhere made out of telesnaps and the soundtrack, but this was just brilliant to see this moving in front of your eyes, something that you never thought you'd see. Okay, of course it's a modern reconstruction, but I thought they did it absolutely brilliantly. It really, really holds up. It's quality-wise, it's good quality television. Of course it's not of the standard of say modern Who, but that's not what that's misunderstanding what they were trying to do. They were trying to recreate.
The task at hand.
Yeah, they were trying to recreate something from the 60s. And so doing that, they did it brilliantly. But that aside, I just thought it was really, really well done. The fact that they have matched the sets so closely, you know, that rocket that they're working on is literally identical to the original. The fact that they've used model work so imaginatively, The acting is really good acting. It's as good as anything you would have seen in 1960s Doctor Who. The Dalek voices are great. Everything about it is brilliant. My only tiny feeling with it was I felt that the music was just ever so slightly too contemporary sounding compared with what was in the 60s. This is really nitpicking minor thing. That would be the only thing that I would really pick up on is it just felt a little bit too modern, the music.
That's interesting because the music, I assumed that it was exactly the same music that would have been used originally.
Oh, there you go.
So for
then.
For me, that soundscape and the music completely melded with the production. Let's take a look at the principal cast for this thing. We've got Mark Corey, who's played by Marco Simeone. Gordon Lowry was played this time by Dan Gilligan, and Jeff Garvey was played by Jacob Marison. They all, with their various degrees of screen time there, those three guys, they played their parts very, very well, didn't they? This was no amateur dramatics level performance. It was completely convincing, completely engaging, and the style of performances somehow managed to tap into the style of acting back in the early to mid 60s, which I think was obviously you'd got that different brand. What heroism represented back then was very different. It was all still very, very pulpy and a little square-jawed. But it had also got the intimacy, because obviously the television was more intimate then, wasn't it? There was a lot more close-ups. And the exchanges, the glances between the characters and the sort of the slightly sweaty brows and things, it felt intoxicating at certain points.
I think, to be honest, it was the acting more than anything that surprised me. No disrespect to anybody that did this recreation. I just wasn't expecting the acting to be that good. I genuinely thought it was, as you say, it was going to feel quite amateur dramatics. And it didn't. The acting in it throughout is really, really good. It stands up there. And as I say, the technical aspects of it stand up as well. I love the fact, I think it was just towards the beginning of the episode, that there is just a little bump. The camera just takes a little bump. and I thought, wow, that would have been so easy to just reshoot that. And they don't reshoot it. And that, of course, is so true to 1960s Doctor Who. How many times do you see a camera just bump in 1960s Doctor Who?
Absolutely. It is all the time, yeah.
So I loved the fact that they'd left that in because that's truthful. So I love the fact that actually they haven't tried to sanitise it and make it to modern standards. They've done it absolutely to what it would have been. And you're right that back in the day, accents were very much received pronunciation, RP as they call it. And so everybody had that very precise, clipped way of speaking. The BBC English, as people jokingly call it. And so they do that. They follow that through. Again, it would have been very easy to bring it up to date by having people with more estuary accents, more modern teenage speak, to make it more accessible to a teenage audience today. That would have been so easy to do. And the fact that they resist the temptation and they do it totally straight, totally true, I just utter respect to them for it.
Because in the script, they actually say at one point, don't they, how Kemble is the most dangerous planet in the universe. It's the most hostile planet in the universe. That's it. And then, but of course, at the time, this wasn't filmed in Limegrove. It was filmed in Ealing originally, and in obviously a student facility now. So to sell that as this hostile environment is another hard sell. But because of the performances, because of the camera work, and this sort of feeling of being isolated and of not sort of growing desperation, really, as truth sinks in, and as they become prey to a virus, in a sense, you do start to believe in it.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because all those early 60s episodes in particular that were made, a lot of them, as you say, were made at Limegrove, at Riverside Studios, so that were tiny, tiny studios. And so a lot of those William Hartnell episodes have a very cramped, claustrophobic feel, which in many cases actually works in their advantage. And so, again, with this recreation, it works again to their advantage that this feels... Okay, it's difficult with a few pot plants to make it feel like it's the most dangerous planet in the universe, but it does have that claustrophobic, intimidating feel to it that they've recreated by the fact that they're filming it in very small spaces. The spaceship is cramped, the jungle is cramped, and so at least it has that sort of similar atmosphere that a lot of those 60s episodes have, that claustrophobia.
And what I was saying earlier on about being a child watching at the time, usually when you feel like that, because you get that feeling a lot with classic Doctor Who, with black and white Doctor Who, and this is why I implore anybody out there who's resisting to watching the really, really old stuff, why they should. Because at moments like that, where we feel that unsettled, and we feel that vulnerable, even and fearing for these characters that we're attaching ourselves to, because I did attach myself to Mark Corey and watching this, usually when that starts to get above a certain level, the action then cuts away to the familiar setting of the TARDIS or the familiar reassuring presence of the Doctor and the companions, but we haven't got that in this. So as events all play out and things get a little bit more desperate, and of course the Daleks do enter the fray, imagine being a child watching that, wondering, is the Doctor, where's the Doctor?
Exactly, because again, we've got to remember that in the days of those episodes originally going out, people didn't really know what the next episode was going to be. They didn't know that at the time that this was a single standalone episode, so that they wouldn't have known that the Doctor wasn't in it. So that you're quite right, they would have spent the entire episode waiting for that to happen. And so the fact that it never does, there is, interestingly, I couldn't actually remember the outcome of the episode from when I'd watched the recreation previously. So I just genuinely couldn't remember who survives to the end and who didn't.
I couldn't either.
But what was interesting, and what I thought they did particularly well in the recreation, is it does have this terrible sense of foreboding and a funereal feel that you just, after about 5 minutes, you're beginning to feel this isn't going to end well for anybody. And the one moment that, for me, the standout moment in the entire episode that really got to me was when Lowry puts his hand out and lifts it back and suddenly realizes he's got a Vargathorn stuck in his hand.
Yeah.
And it was just so, I'd forgotten that happened. And so all credit to them, that really got to me. I just felt such sympathy for this character, this poor bloke.
It's because they underplay, don't
yes.
they? They underplay every single bit of it.
Absolutely.
Knowing, I suppose, that the closeness of television then would amplify any tiny physical gesture or any facial sort of tick that they may put on.
That's
they dial it all back.
That's right. And it was just as I say, the way it was acted, that one scene was, it was just, it was all, you're quite right, it was all very underplayed. The whole episode was underplayed. Again, there might have been a temptation for students making this to get quite excitable and overplayed and almost get a bit hammy. And they don't. The whole thing is just all, it's all very quiet. It's underplayed. And again, they stick to the true spirit of the thing. I'm not certain. I must be uncertain whether you know this, Dan, whether the actors were students, whether they were graduates, whether they were professional actors. I don't know. Do you know?
I don't quite know. I mean, they do say, what was it I said earlier on, that it's graduates and staff. So I think it's different people in different capacities who are associated with the facility, who probably all come together to help one another. Apparently this facility, the UCLan, has existed for some years now, and Mandit Gill, who of course is in the present cast, plays Yaz in the present series of Doctor Who, she's a graduate of this thing and sent along her best wishes to the production, I understand. But yeah, it's a cooperative, I think. So I would imagine that people continue to be involved maybe some years afterwards. And Dr. Andrew Ireland himself has directed and produced this. And some of those sequences that you were talking about earlier on, I wondered about that, whether it was, because I didn't look up any of this before I watched it. I came to it just waiting to see how it would, what effect it would have on me. And but as I think the opening credits, when they finished, I'd say for the first 30 to 45 seconds, I was sort of on the outside thinking, oh, okay. Oh, right. Oh, they've done. Oh. And then it was certainly little more than a minute later, I was completely in that world. And in my head, I was watching an episode of Doctor Who from 1965. Absolutely, the way that the director tracked the action across the studio, what was the studio floor, and focusing on tiny movements of leaves and all the little details of the set before panning up to the rocket. This was exactly how 1960s episodes of Doctor Who look now, even down to as we stood and we can see that whole rocket, which is a small rocket. It's in the script, isn't it? It's like a small rocket ship. They make a virtue of that fact. But I was looking at the metallic surface of it. I've no idea what that rocket was really made out of. But the surface, as the camera and light catches that surface, it is exactly the glimmers that one gets watching black and white period Doctor Who. So it completely, that plus the performances, I was absolutely back in 1965. There's no question about it. And I was thinking afterwards, you know, as it all continued and we go inside the rocket and see some of the technology that they're using, they're sending messages back and things like that, and all this equipment, which at the time when they would have made the original one, it would have been brought out of a prop store, wouldn't it, and the same piece of kit would turn up in not just other Doctor Who's but movies and things on other channels or any number of things these bits would turn up in. I think to have sourced all that and put it together, I mean, eventually I may look at comparison photographs between this production and the 65 one, but for the moment I'm quite happy to live with this one and not to look at it to that degree, because this felt like a whole production. I understand that certain sequences, as you mentioned, they use models at certain points in it, and yeah, you could tell that there were models in play. They were cutting from models to a Dalek proper, a working Dalek replica that a Dalek builder would have probably built. But even so, what that reminded me of other Doctor Who serials, and I don't think they did that in the case of the original Mission to the Unknown. I believe that it was built as a free set, but there were plenty of examples where they did use model Daleks in things like Power of the Daleks as substitutes for full-size Daleks. So that's okay too, isn't it?
As far as I'm concerned, absolutely. They're still keeping it within the scope of how it would have been made at the time. If, at the time, this had been a single standalone episode and they weren't going to then bring that set back for the Daleks Master Plan, they probably would have just done it with models.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's the only reason that the BBC built the set, was because it was going to be reused then for the Daleks Master Plan for 12 episodes. But if it hadn't,
it was the, Time Destructor, it was used in that way.
But if it hadn't, they would have just, as I say, they probably would have done it with models. So it's still perfectly in keeping, and it doesn't worry me in the slightest that, yes, you're quite right. You can tell that it's that they're suddenly cut to models. But let's be perfectly honest, in the modern series, I can suddenly tell when they're suddenly cut to CGI. So, you know, where's the difference?
No difference at all. You're right.
It's all good. It's all that's how it was made at the time. And so, as I say, they've stayed faithful to that. I mean, what I would be really interested to know is how faithfully they have stayed to the original camera script. I know they had access to the original camera script.
Apparently,
and
so.
Yeah,
and the telesnaps you mentioned, they had those to hand to.
Correct. So they would have been able to frame it up correct to the telesnaps, and they'll have been able to literally follow the camera script that will have told them when to cut to a wide shot on camera one, when to cut to a close-up on camera two. I don't know whether they have slavishly followed that. You know, did they have a book of the telesnaps or on an iPad, the telesnaps there to match up the framing? I don't know. I'm interested to know that only because, you know, hey, as a geeky Doctor Who fan, we worry about these things. And I'm just interested to know whether how truthful a visual camera recreation it is of the original episode, or how much they just use that as a sort of a basis, and then the director himself decided, well, no, I know they had a wide shot there, but artistically I want a close-up here, so that's what we're going to do. And I'm interested to know that, and I'm hoping that maybe we will learn a little bit more as time goes on, because you're quite right, this has been so well received. It's 126,000 views so far on YouTube.
Really?
Within 3 days, and that is going to go up as people start to find out about it. So I'm hoping that. I mean, in many ways, I don't know your feeling on this, but in many ways, firstly, you're right that I think it's the most interesting thing to have in the Doctor Who world so far this year. And secondly, what I was seeing, the sort of frisson of excitement as we were running up to this transmission, which in effect it was on the 9th of October, everybody's so excited about it. I just got the feeling there was more, sorry, but there felt more excitement about this than they did about series 12. I'm sorry, but they just did. People seem to really have taken this on board. I know it's a controversial thing to say, and you can comment. Yeah, well, but you know what I'm saying. Well, there was.
I know exactly what you mean.
It was.
It's because even that aside about series 12 and any number of things, we are at the moment as time is as we record this, a hungry fan base.
Yes,
we've yet again weathered another gap year, and this is nothing against the achievements, the abilities, and the contribution and generosity of UCLan in mounting this and letting us see it. I'm immensely grateful. So it's not a slight on that at all. This isn't a consolation prize.
Not
this
in any way.
Always going to be a huge boon to any year in Doctor Who's history. But fandom has responded with open arms to this for the most part. Even people who maybe haven't got round to seeing it, or maybe they won't see it. I don't know. If you don't plan on watching this, think again. It's going to be up on YouTube for however long. Please, please, please think again. Because for however low res it may well be, and a little bit fuzzy and of its time. Hey, if you've been holding back on watching any black and white Doctor Who, any old Doctor Who, this is a great sampler for the pace of drama back then. Because, you know, I found that with this as well, because with the pacing of drama from back then, sometimes I can get a little bit sleepy watching it. And sure enough, I got that watching that too. And I don't mind. I don't mind for a single moment, because that is the job. That's the job done. They've recreated. They've given us back a piece that we lost.
That's right. And what's interesting as well is that fandom could have reacted quite badly to it. There could have been a point where fandom was saying, "Oh, why are you allowing students of all people to sort of be sacrilegious to 1960s classic Doctor Who by letting them recreate it?" It could have been really badly received. But you're quite right. It's been quite the opposite. People have really responded well to this. A, they were intrigued and really wanted to see it, but B, from what I can see, all the responses so far have been nothing short of fantastic. Everybody has loved what they've seen. This could have been torn to shreds, given what social media is like. This could have been literally massacred on social media, and it hasn't. From what I can see, everybody loves it.
I think for the most part that that whole thing about things being dated is largely a thing of the past now. I think people know that people may know whether something's for them or not, you know, or seriousness. I do get that. But here we have this wonderful snapshot that it all exists there, and everything that's been preserved, everything that's been recaptured, everything that's been said, all that stuff about. Mark Corey, for example, he's licensed to kill, isn't he? You know, this was at the height of the Bond movies. Aligns it very much so with an attempt to do a space James Bond, which I'm sure Terry Nation had that in mind when he was planning that Dalek series. There's that. There's all the hangover from the 1950s of what you could call body horror or creature features. The whole The Thing, The Day of the Triffids, all that's present too, just in a very sort of homespun and safe, just right on the cusp between being safe and too strong way. So all that's in there too. So in isolation, I suppose, even without the Doctor Who credits on it, it just works. I think you're right in what you said before. Doctor Who of the age was something so standout and so cutting edge, ahead of its time, however you want to look at it, because there is something, this, when you compare this, any version of this, any even just on paper of this, it does seem older than the Doctor Who's that star the Doctor. Somehow it does seem more of the 50s. But that's because, I suppose, because culture was still in a transitional phase at that point in 65, Simon. How do you view that?
Yeah, I think you're right. This standalone episode almost does feel like it's something out of the 50s, because it does follow on from that, as I mentioned earlier. It's very, very pulpy in feel. And part of that, I think, is down to Terry Nation, because as good a writer as he is, and he is, I'm not criticising him at all, he had a very particular style, which was, if anything, somewhat dated in a way. Date is the wrong word. Old-fashioned is a kind of word. Dated suggests it's a criticism, yeah. And I don't mean that as a criticism. Some of my favourite stuff is sort of 50s pulp SF. So he had a very sort of old-fashioned outlook. But as I say, to me, that was his appeal. I was amused endlessly as I was watching this Mission to the Unknown about how cavalier he is with regards to what is a universe, what is a cosmos, what is the galaxy, what is the solar system.
It's all interchangeable, isn't it?
He hasn't got a clue. He doesn't know what a galaxy is, what a universe is, what a solar system is. It's all over the shop. That again is part of his appeal. That, to me, that's how Terry Nation was, and that's why I personally love him as a writer.
I suppose that the everyday man in the street, what we knew then about space exploration, about the scientific understanding at the time, it was all about to change. It was all about to revolutionise, wasn't it? And what we all knew about that sort of thing. So the language was about to change, and I open up on what was taught in schools and all that sort of thing. Earlier on, Simon, you mentioned the music, but very, very quickly I wanted to ask you this question about authenticity. Have they done the right thing? You know, I love Nick Briggs. His contribution to Doctor Who, fantastic, and he's a really nice guy. And his Dalek voices, they send shivers up my spine like no other. But did they do the right thing getting Nick Briggs in to do this, or should they use the original Dalek voices?
That's a really interesting question. I think Nick Briggs, I agree with you, does a fantastic job with the Dalek voices. And the one thing I love about what he does with them is the fact that he is able to give so many different and varied Dalek voices in his delivery. And I think, yes, they did do the right thing in getting Nick Briggs to do the voices, for the simple fact that this was a recreation. It's not the original. They're not trying to make out that it's the original. So on the one hand, yeah, I would have loved to have heard the original.
There is a conflict there, though, isn't it? Because they are trying to recreate an original production from the 60s.
They are, and of course, theoretically, they could have just used the original Peter Hawkins Dalek voices. They are very, very recognisable, those Peter Hawkins voices and David Graham. They're very, very recognisable Dalek voices. And so, the temptation would have been to use them. So part of me would have liked to have heard that. But as I say, because they weren't, that's not what they were doing. They were not they were not doing the original. They were recreating something. I think it was probably correct. They were bringing everything else up to date, because by that ruling, you could basically have just used the entire original soundtrack and all of the actors could have just mimed to the original soundtrack. But that wouldn't have been the right thing either. That's not what they were doing. So, yes, I think they were doing the right thing. And actually, the Nick Briggs voices aren't that far off those original Peter Hawkins, David Graham deliveries from the original episode anyway. It's not like something like Day of the Daleks, for example, where the voices sound like nothing any other Dalek you've ever heard in the entire history of Doctor Who. They're very unique voices in Day of the Daleks. But these were just classic early 60s Dalek voices. And I think Nick Briggs does a good job of sort of recreating that style without going too far into modern 21st century Dalek voices. So I thought, no, it was absolutely the right decision to do that.
I think the big thing that it's done for me as well is that, you know, I haven't watched any black and white Doctor Who all year, and it's made me want to go and watch the recon of the entire Dalek Master Plan. No, it really has.
Doesn't it just make you want a black and white Blu-ray? That's what it does to me. I just want a black and white Blu-ray soon.
It does. Because for those who may not be aware, the story does eventually pick up with another space agent, Brett Vian, who's played by Nicholas Courtney, of course, who would later be the Brigadier. But yeah, Agent Vian then investigates what happened to Agent Corey, and that carries on. That kicks off, doesn't it, the 12-part story, the Dalek Master Plan, also written by Terry Nation and Dennis Spooner, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like a joint effort, but they would pick that up and run with it to create this enormous, legendary Doctor Who story, of which three parts still exist, something like that, isn't it? It's only about three or four episodes that still exist. So we have to take in that however we can. But we're going to take a short break now. We're going to be back in a minute, so don't start skipping or do anything silly like that. because we'd be letting you down if we didn't remind you about all the other conversations that happen elsewhere on the Fandom Podcast Network, because there's all these other shows you may enjoy listening to. And here's a friend of ours with a few words about all of that. Check this out.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. For you Highlander fans, we've got Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we cover all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater is for you movie buffs, our podcast celebrating the cult classics and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. We also have End Zone for you NFL fans, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with hosts Tom, Brandon, and Chris discussing the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. And for you Star Trek Discovery and Orville fans, we have Discoville, talking about everything Discovery and the Orville. And for you hard rock music fans, we have the Hair Metal podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And we also have Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, where we discuss all things Doctor Who, both past and present. And our newest podcast, Lethal Mullet, our podcast celebrating action movies from the 1980s with your host, Adam P. O'Brien. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, and now on Spotify. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network, on Instagram, Fandom Podcast Network, and also on Twitter at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at FandomPodcastNetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
The FPNet, Simon, it's taken its first step into a larger world recently. The Star Wars world, that is, with the launch of the What a Piece of Junk podcast. I've heard the first one a couple of days ago, and between you and me, it's my favourite show on the network now. Scott and Derek, they're the hosts, and they open up with a sort of a very casual geek out about everything Star Wars on both the big screen and small screen at the time, at this very crucial time. I think we're all hoping for great things for Star Wars sooner rather than later, aren't we, Simon? You're a big Star Wars fan.
Oh, Dan, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. But I think I've said before that The Last Jedi nearly finished me off as a Star Wars fan. I loved The Force Awakens. I thought it was a brilliant film. And to me, they really badly dropped the ball with the Last Jedi to the extent where I literally found myself going off The Force Awakens then. They really blew it for me. Big time. I'm quite happy to hold my hands up. But a huge Star Wars fan, apart from that. And I'll go and listen to the podcast. And I'm very, very excited about seeing the new episode at Christmas. So bring it on.
Well, the good thing about this podcast is that all views are represented. You know, I feel very much the same way you do. But they've got a great cross section on the podcast, and they play with a lot of these issues and topics and the things that fans are talking about out there, which I think all the best podcasts do that, have those conversations. And as we know, there are a hell of a lot of connections between Star Wars and Doctor Who. So I'd like to get the boys in at some point for some sort of intergalactic crossover. We'll see if we can speak to them about that. There are no missing episodes of Star Wars, though, are there? You know,
no, although I'd like Last Jedi to be missing, but there we go.
I was saying, well, George Lucas did try his best. He tried to make the holiday special disappear, didn't he?
Yeah, but we've all still seen it. for our sins.
This is a uniquely Doctor Who situation, so nobody has to remake anything Star Wars related. Let's hope they never do. But... going back to talking about Mission to the Unknown in 2019, we've got this production, Simon, that is in effect, it's gently, and I don't know if it's accidentally or not, but it's kind of broken the mould and made our year. But it is still, despite the YouTube premiere, it's a fan film. But it's significant. It being a fan film that has been granted permission by the BBC and the Terry Nation Estate, and then showcased in this way for the entire world to enjoy. It's given me those tingles, Simon. It's given me those fan tingles. It's just like the first time I heard that there was such a thing as a reconstruction, and when I heard that BBC DVD was going to be animating the missing episodes of The Invasion, those same sorts of tingles, to the point where I'm wondering where this could potentially go. How exciting and promising this could be for more of the same. Has this struck you too?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I agree that I was as excited about this as when I first... Yeah, I think The Invasion was the first one that they animated the missing episodes for, wasn't it? Yeah. And the truth of it is, As a classic Doctor Who fan, I really want to see those episodes that are missing. And so to a large extent, I don't really mind how I see them. I know sometimes the animation gets stick for not being the best animation. Well, I don't care. I'm not good at sitting listening to just a soundtrack. I much better to seeing something visually as well. So I don't care how I see them. I just want to see them. And so this, for me, as I say, feel very, very legitimate. It's as good as we're going to get, probably, of Mission to the Unknown. I suspect this will end up on the Blu-ray once they release that season. I'd be amazed if they don't.
I'd say so too.
The question, of course, is do they carry on? I mean, it's difficult because this is obviously just part of their course. They just happen to have done this as part of their course. So nice as this is, they can't run their entire course just making recreations of Doctor Who episodes for you and me. They've got a degree to do.
Well, this is it. I did wonder, was it just me that was thinking this? But it isn't. As we said earlier on, there was a Q&A at the launch for this when they were filming this, and present was Peter Purvis, who played Stephen Taylor back, even though he wasn't in the original episode, he was in the general cast there, and he got a quote from Peter from that afternoon, and he says, "This is an absolutely wonderful project. Even more so, as this is a episode that was a one-off introduction to the 12-part Dalek Master Plan. I can remember at that time that we, that is Bill Hartnell and me, were a bit miffed not to be included in any way at all. But actually, it was a nice week off in the end." So, you know, he's Peter's obviously behind this project, behind these people and this unit, I think, and from what I hear, he's asking questions. He's sort of doing his bit to push it forward too. So with the actors, you know, and he's not going to be in it if they do make any more. He's not going to be part of it. But
no, but there's no reason why he couldn't be in, as if, and this is a big if, but if they were to go ahead and make more episodes, they're all obviously going to be entirely recast. So there's no reason why Peter Purvis couldn't thus play a different part. Absolutely no reason at all. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because again, I can see there's a very clear and obvious reason why you can do Mission to the Unknown, because of the fact that none of the regular cast are in it. Somehow there's something almost sacred about the core cast, the main regular cast, in particular the Doctor, as played by Bill Hartnell. Do you recast him and recreate them? Well, of course, you know, there's two ways of looking at that. Some people are automatically going to say, no, you just can't do that. But then I kind of thinking, well, why can't you? They've recast the first Doctor before. You had Richard Herndl. You've had David, his name escapes
David
me.
David Bradley.
Thank you. David Bradley has played the part. And when you look at that adventure in space and time, every part is recast in that. The whole point is that's a very specific thing. Yeah. It's a drama. It's a dramatisation of something that happened back in the 60s. So these would be exactly the same. They're dramatisations of something that happened back in the 60s. They're their own dramatisation of 60s episodes. So I genuinely can't see why you can't do other episodes and recast all of the regular cast and put new people in. It's as legitimate,
I suppose,
as the five
for somebody
doctors.
Like Peter. I suppose for somebody like Peter, with so many of his cast members and crewmates, colleagues from that time, no longer with us, you know, and Peter himself getting up there in years, it stands as a nice testament to what they all achieved then, that the material was good. Not just that people wish it still existed, but that it could be remounted, revisited, reappraised. It's not as if he'd be airbrushed out of its history. I think Anika Wills has also got a very similar philosophy to it when her character Polly was obviously recast for Twice Upon a Time a couple of Christmases ago alongside David Bradley. Her certainly her public words were, you know, who's this lovely young actress playing my role? I'd like to meet her. I want to congratulate her and I want to connect with her. You know, look how small a role that was. I think as a fan base, as a community, including the stars in that, everybody's sort of over it, aren't they? That I think we've come to a place where we realise it's not necessarily disrespectful.
I agree. It's got nothing to do with being disrespectful any more than, for example, Big Finish have recast the Doctors in audio dramas for those. There's nothing disrespectful about it. As you say, we're not erasing, we're not disowning anything from the 60s. It's just that if certain stuff doesn't exist, then why not try to remake it in some format? I genuinely feel it would be ridiculous to remake anything that exists within the archive. Of course, I don't think anybody would even bother trying to do that. There would be no point at all in redoing that. But remaking something that doesn't exist so people can actually watch it and enjoy it in the way that you and I and everybody else has watched and enjoyed Mission into the Unknown, I would be surprised if anybody would. There wouldn't be many people, I don't think, that would have any animosity towards that as a suggestion, because you've nothing to lose. But then, having said that, it never ceases to amaze me how grumbly people get when they read that they have done CGI effects on the Blu-rays, and people get. I've been critical of some of the CGI effects, but what I'm not critical about is putting them on there. Brilliant. Do it, put them on. Some people get really uppity about, well, I hope I'm going to get the original version as the default. Well, of course you are. You know, calm down, dear. It's just some CGI effects. So maybe I'm underestimating that actually some people would have a really bad reaction to trying to redo the entirety of, let's say, Marco Polo without the original cast. I don't know. Maybe people would. I'd hope they wouldn't. Maybe they would.
I think all life is out there. And when I hear about projects like this, and most recently, I was looking sideways in popular culture to something else that I dearly love almost as much as Doctor Who, and the BBC sitcom Dad's Army, which is made from 1968 through to about 77. But this is over the last few years, it's acted as a bit of a testing ground, because there are three episodes of Dad's Army missing from the archives for exactly the same reasons that the Doctor Who's are missing. But over the last few years, there's been several inroads made into bringing that material also to that fan base and giving it extra life. First of all, they used animation to recreate an episode called The Battle of Godfrey's Cottage. And that exact same animation team, they used the techniques. I think that this was always part of the plan. The same team that worked on that were the team that secured the commission to animate for a complete story for the first time. This second wave of animations we're now getting that began with Power of the Daleks, they started by doing that half an hour Dad's Army. So I think there's definitely a continuity there, which of course is carrying on now. We get these annual stories. But by the same measure, if I look across to Dad's Army again, a couple of months ago, we'd got the three missing episodes of Dad's Army again were completely remounted, albeit in colour and widescreen. They were completely remounted by UK TV for the channel Gold. All those iconic parts recast with obviously new actors, but using the shooting scripts, rebuilding the sets exactly as they were they would have been for series two of Dad's Army, and recording it in front of a live studio audience. So simulating next to the exact same conditions of those original productions 50 years ago, and it was done with obviously for UK TV, which is it's partly owned by BBC Worldwide, so it's a commercial entity, so there was other money involved. So looking at this, which would have been done considerably cheaper than those Dad's Armies, at some point, I believe that conversations are going to be had. And it wouldn't surprise me if we either get more productions like what UCLan have done, or maybe even something that little bit of a step up, because I think that probably investment would be required. So, but with the animations, they get investment from BBC America. Is that something that BBC America would be interested in getting involved with? Or would it be something that UK TV themselves would also be interested in, if not for, certainly not for Gold, because it's a comedy-orientated channel, but maybe for something like Drama or their channel W, or just to be part of something that would be a commercial venture, which could maybe even premiere on Blu-ray. Is there anything of that has a ring of truth to it?
Yes, I think the truth of it is, I think probably the university that's made Mission to the Unknown probably will be forever remembered as the people that started the ball rolling on recreations, rather than the ones that actually run and do lots of recreations. Because, say, simply, the way I look at it, they simply can't do that because it's a university and they're doing a degree course. So I think it's far more likely, as you say, that it will become a commercial venture where the BBC would have to put money in to actually doing a similar job to what UCLA and have done, but doing it in a commercial basis using a commercial crew and a commercial cast, because I can't see any other way of doing it. You cut the BBC would be...
Someone's got to pay for it.
Yeah, and the BBC would be looked upon very badly if they just basically relied on universities up and down the country to suddenly start, you know, which episode of Doctor Who do you want to remake? So we can put it out on Blu-ray. It would start to look somewhat dodgy. They can't do that. So I think, as I say, the university will be seen as the people that started the ball rolling, if indeed the BBC then decide to pick up the baton. I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? Do they just leave it as they've done so far with animation recreations? Because as expensive as animation is, it's still going to be cheaper than actually commercially, professionally mounting what these guys have just done with Mission to the Unknown. Don't know. It's a tough call, isn't it?
It's a very tough
call. Yeah, and I guess one of the interesting things that would have to be borne in mind with all that is how well these Blu-rays are selling. Because if the BBC are doing well with the Blu-rays, and can thus justify pouring some money into recreations that then would be put onto Blu-ray and sold, then maybe there is something in that. But whatever, it's still going to be astronomically more expensive than it would be to animate the Macra Terra, for example, or Power of the Daleks, as they've done previously. So it's difficult to quite see where this will go from here. The way I look at it, it is, even if this is just an isolated incident and a madcap experiment and a one-off and that's it, fine, brilliant. It's been a brilliant experiment, well worth doing, and I'm delighted that it's out there.
Well, I'm delighted, you're delighted. Peter Purvis is delighted. Going back to his quote, he says, "I am intrigued to see what has been done and hope it could be a precursor to more reconstructions in the future." Exact quote. There we are. I knew I'd read it somewhere. So who knows what the future holds in store. I'd like to congratulate again everybody involved in Mission to the Unknown 2019. I'll be watching and waiting and listening closely. I imagine you will as well, Simon.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see what they get up to next. And as I say, I'm just looking forward to hearing a little bit more about the making of, in many ways. It needs to be a really in-depth making of on YouTube, I'd say.
Yeah, there's a nice little feature from Joshua Snares, who makes such great YouTube videos. It's a light and fluffy piece, but done with his requisite enthusiasm and creativity. But yeah, I think there's a lot more bigger story that can be told. And the new Mission to the Unknown is available on the official BBC Doctor Who YouTube channel. And yeah, if enough people watch it, if enough people respond and start asking these questions and raving the way we have, Simon, who knows where it could end. Time's up for us, I think. The old fluid link needs replacing. Not the Type 40s, mine. I need to go to the gents. I'll be back. But I will be back with some more Type 40 very soon. If you look out for that wherever you found this. It could have been on Apple Podcasts, if you can search for the Fandom Podcast Network. On what used to be iTunes, it's now Apple Podcasts. Apple, that's the black country coming out in me. Apple Podcasts, drop us a review. It's not just for our egos here. It's so new listeners can find us easier. So if you bump us up, ideally with a five stars. Subliminal, five stars. Could have been you found us on the Podbean app or Stitcher, Google Play or Spotify. It's so easy to use over at Spotify. I love that too. You can search for us through the Fandom Podcast Network Master Feed. You can find all our listings there. If you're feeling brave, you can always contact us directly. Email type40doctorwho@gmail.com, Twitter and Instagram at type40doctorwho, our Facebook page and the Facebook group type40doctorwho. All that extra dimensional chat in real time. And remind us where people can find you, Simon.
Yeah, they can go find me on Facebook under The Hoonatics, and I will be there as one of the admins. Come and say hello.
It's always a pleasure, mate. Thanks for the chat. And thanks to you for listening out there. Join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast where we always have the time if you have the space.